Assembly to order. Welcome. I am Sarah Grace Heller, and I'm the Associate Director of the Center for Medieval and Renaissance Studies. I'm very pleased to see all of you here today on this beautiful April afternoon. Our director, Richard Firth Green, is alas away at a conference in his honor in Toronto today, along with a good part of the English department. So we wish him well and think of him being honored up in Canada right now. And very, very pleased to welcome Robert Hanning today. I'm going to do some business at the beginning here. Things to announce. This is the second to the last lecture in the mapping series this year. The next lecture and final lecture will be on May 18th, Friday, here in this same place, by Professor Jorge Flores of the European University Institute in Florence. He's actually a Portuguese scholar. He's going to be speaking on cartography, iconography, and ethnography in early modern Portuguese Asia. So crossing over ends of the Mediterranean there. We also have a film series that's going on right now. It's quite splendid with Professor Fudge's class. Where are you, Bruce? There you are. How's that going?
Swimmingly.
All right. So on the 9th, you can view the second part of the Arabian Nights from 1974, the Pasolini version. It's 7:30 in 56 University Hall. And then on the 23rd of May, we'll be screening The 13th Warrior. What is that?
It's based on a novel that's partly based on a 10th century account of an Arab traveler who went from Baghdad up the Volga and met the Vikings.
Well, so you can combine the Arabian Nights and the Vikings.
Yep.
What could be better? So please join us for that film series. I also want to announce our spring party is coming up. And that will be the moment where we announce the Hannah Wolf Awards, the Carl Awards for papers, as well as the Howe Awards for graduate students, allowing them to go on research trips. And it's also a moment to eat nice things together. And that will be from 4 to 6 p.m. on the 23rd of May at the Humanities Institute. Is that right? Have we moved it?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. Tonight, over at Capital University, the Early Interval is going to be performing Songs from Marie de France. So they want you to go to that if you're interested. Professor Coulson right here has his call for papers out and about. So if you're interested in presenting a paper on the textual traditions, very interested in medieval textual traditions for the Center for Epigraphical and Paleographical Studies. There is a handout. I think most of you have it. So if you don't have one, we have a sign-up sheet in the back by Nick, in case this is your first CMRX or you're not on our mailing list and you would like to be. Is there anything else back there I need to remember?
Copies of Nouvelle.
Okay, copies of Nouvelle, which is our very, very beautiful newsletter, full of items that you may wish to see. Our normal procedure for these talks is to have the talk and then a brief question and answer period. So it's an excellent time to pose burning and immediate questions as well as shorter questions, possibly. And then we'll have time for refreshments over here, time to sneak out if that's what you need to do on this Friday afternoon. And then if you'd like to have a more in-depth conversation, get to know Professor Hanning off the page a little bit. If you want to talk about Boccaccio, because that's been excised from the talk, please gather around the table. It's a very collegial and very interesting time, and we'll spend another 45 minutes or so speaking after the talk. Okay. Without further ado, it is my great pleasure and honor, I'm rather humbled actually, to introduce to you today Professor Robert W. Hanning. He's Professor Emeritus of English and Comparative Literature from Columbia University. He did his undergraduate work at Columbia, and then he moved down to Oxford for a BA and an MA, went back to Columbia for his PhD, and then taught there for 45 years, from 1963 to 2006. And he taught at a number of other places, such as Breadloaf, Middlebury College, Oxford, Yale, John Hopkins, NYU, Princeton. And he's received many illustrious awards, the ACLS, Guggenheim, NEH Fellowships. He's a fellow of the Medieval Academy of America and a trustee of the New Chaucer Society. His areas of expertise include English and French medieval literature, Chaucer, Cinquecento, Italian courtly literature, and the cultural function of medieval narrative forms. But these interests may be genetically grounded in Professor Hanning's case, as his surname goes back to the Domesday Book in England, and on the other side of his family, he's descended from a Sicilian grandfather who came to New York at the age of 17, probably speaking little to no English, managed to start up several businesses, marry several times, twice. Nine children, am I remembering that number right? And died before the age of 40. So if we all had that much energy, I think that Professor Hanning has inherited some of it there. This mixed ancestry is a nice mirror, I think, for Professor Hanning's hybrid career, which has extended beyond narrow temporal and national boundaries. He's taught courses on constructions of race and ethnicity in the fortunes of immigrant groups in America, as well as co-teaching for many, many years art and literature of the Renaissance with an art historian colleague, David Rosen. He's published books on medieval historiography and romance, including The Vision of History in Early Britain, from Gilles Das to Geoffrey of Monmouth, and The Individual in 12th Century Romance. He's co-edited an anthology, several essay collections. He co-translated with Joan Ferrante, whom I think of as more of a Dante scholar, the Lay of Marie de France. A lovely fresh drift, Reading Medieval Culture, Essays in Honor of Robert W. Hanning, was published in 2005 on the eve of his retirement, with essays by many of his great friends and students. And I think, again, the contents speak to the wonderful wide range of capabilities. His lecture today, note the title has slightly morphed from what you'll see on the poster, is Caught Mapping, Ariosto and the Cartographic Revolution of the European Renaissance. Please help me welcome Professor Hanning.
Thank you so much for that more than generous introduction. I'm delighted to be here. I can't be here at Ohio State without thinking momentarily and sadly of my old friend Nicholas Howe, who was here for so many years, and Professor Heller and I were talking a bit about him earlier today, or was it last night, what a great travel writer he was, among other things. So I'm happy to be here on turf that was once his as well. A brief apology, the fact that the talk is now exclusively about Ariosto has something to do with the fact that, at least in my experience, Ariosto expands to fill all available space, and he sort of muscled Boccaccio out of this talk. But if anyone so disappointed at this that you want to talk to me a little bit about what I might have said about Boccaccio had there been world enough and time, I'm happy to do so. The other thing I should say is that in an effort to keep this talk from being a little shorter than the Orlando Furioso, I did trim a bit off at the end, and it means that, in fact, on your handout list, the last two items, these are all the Italian of things that I'm reading in translation, the last two items, in fact, no longer appear. They ended up on the cutting room floor. I think that's it for the introduction. If we are to believe Ludovico Ariosto's poetic persona, a risky business at best, the poet himself was pretty much a homebody, at least as much as the events and obligations of his life allowed it. Ariosto, who lived from 1474 to 1533, spent most of his adult life fetching and carrying for his patrons, first Cardinal Ippolito and later Duke Alfonso of the House of Este, which ruled a small but influential northern Italian state whose capital city was Ferrara. During all these years, according to his seven more or less autobiographical satires, Ariosto longed for a quiet life, free of courtly and administrative duties, so that he could concentrate on completing, and subsequently twice revising, his major artistic legacy, the 39,000-line poem Orlando Furioso, Orlando Gone Mad, one of the greatest artistic achievements of the Italian Renaissance, a monumental synthesis of comedy and tragedy, epic and romance, that drew inspiration from classical, medieval, and earlier Renaissance literature while responding to the social thought, artistic expression, and political catastrophes of contemporaneous Italy. When Cardinal Ippolito d'Este moved to Hungary in 1517 and asked the poet to accompany him as an aide, Ludovico flat out refused to go, preferring to leave the cardinal's service and its financial support altogether rather than travel so far afield. In a famous, oft-quoted passage from the third satire, written to Ariosto's cousin, Annibale Malaguzzi, in May 1518, Ariosto defends his antipathy to such journeys in the flesh while revealing a taste for what we would call armchair travel that locates him within a context of 15th and 16th century European innovations in the construction, interpretation, and use of maps. Here's the passage in the translation of Peter de Sa Wiggins. The original is number one on your handout. Quote, "In my house, a turnip tastes better to me that I cook myself than at someone else's table thrush, partridge, or wild boar. And I go to bed at home beneath a humble covering as if it were made of silk or of gold brocade. And I'm more pleased to rest my idle limbs than to boast that they have been to Scythia, India, Ethiopia, and beyond. Let him wander who desires to wander. Let him see England, Hungary, France, and Spain. I'm content to live in my native land. I have seen Tuscany, Lombardy, and the Romagna, and the mountain range that divides Italy, and the one that locks her in, and both the seas that wash her. And that is quite enough for me. Without ever paying an innkeeper, I will go exploring the rest of the earth with Ptolemy, whether the world be at peace or else at war. Without ever making vows when the heavens flash with lightning, I will go bounding over all the seas, more secure aboard my maps than aboard ships." Unquote. In other words, Ariosto hates, or at least wishes to avoid, real travel, its inconveniences, paying innkeepers, and dangers, storms while at sea, but is devoted to visiting places far beyond the Italy he knows by experience with the aid of an expert guidebook identified as Ptolemy. These lines raise interesting questions, such as, given the poet's purely temperamental dislike for the dangers and discomforts of travel, what in his cultural milieu might explain his counterbalancing predilection for imagined voyages to places far away? Is Ptolemy a key factor here? And how does he fit in to the Renaissance cartography with which Ariosto would be familiar? And finally, what correspondence, if any, is there between the views expressed in Satire 3 and the representation in Orlando Furioso of travel, travelers, and the maps they might use? I'll suggest some answers, admittedly provisional and incomplete, to these questions, but in reverse order, starting with the Furioso itself, and noting that Renaissance cartographers distinguished, though not always consistently, among three levels of territory to be mapped. Geography, that dealt with the largest units to be depicted, such as the world as a whole or its constituent continents. Chorography, with more compact areas, such as regions. And topography, which zeroed in on particulars, such as the street plans of cities or the layouts of fortresses. The Furioso is replete with passages offering textual parallels to each of these cartographic categories. One example must stand for many. In this case, a kind of double chorography, pairing by means of analogy a place that, if we're to believe Satire 3, the poet never saw with another, certainly within his field of personal experience. In Canto 4, two knights seek a mysterious castle, I quote the translation of Guido Waldman. The Italian is number two on your handout. Quote, across mountains and through forests they traveled until they came to the heights of the Pyrenees, which command a view, if the air is not murky, of both France and Spain, and of two separate shores, just as from the saddle in the Apennines on the approach to Camaldoli, both the Slavonian and the Tuscan seas ought to be viewed at once, unquote. More interesting than the Furioso's varied landscape per se is the presence within the poem of some characters who stand out as their creator's surrogates and yet his opposites, people who share with Ariosto the pleasure of seeing new places, but who indulge that pleasure by actual, not imagined, or as we might say, virtual journeys. I'm referring to the English Duke Astolfo, the eventual finder on the moon of the wits Orlando loses when frustrated love drives him mad, and Ruggiero, the young Saracen knight who is destined to marry Bradamante, a beautiful and accomplished female Christian warrior, and with her to engender the lineage of Ariosto's Este patrons. Despite their respective grave responsibilities in the larger economy of the poem, these two heroes embrace grand itineraries, gratuitous in nature, rather than in response to the orders of superiors or the machinations of fortune. Ruggiero first appears as an accidental tourist. Having been freed by Bradamante from a castle created by Atlante, an old magician who seeks to protect him from an early death, Ruggiero is flown against his will by the hippogriff, a winged creature, partly horse, partly griffin, halfway around the world to an island where he's imprisoned again, this time by the Circe-like seductress Alcina, only to be rescued once more, this time by Bradamante's tutelary magician, Melissa, and brought to the realm of a good fairy, Logistilla, on another part of the same island. Soon, it's time for him to return to France, but his preference is not to retrace the route by which he came. Instead, he will continue on in the same direction and complete a circuit of the world, and this is the third handout. Quote, this time he was disposed to see other lands than those where Aeolus incites the winds, and to complete the circle he had started so as to girdle the earth like the sun. For all his pressing desire to return to Bradamante, Ruggiero was unwilling to forego the pleasure of discovering the world, unquote. Astolfo manifests similar desires. In Canto 22 of Orlando Furioso, with the help of a book that allows him to recognize magic spells and seek their antidotes, Astolfo dismantles yet another of Atlanta's castles of illusion, and in the process finds the hippogriff tethered there, and this is the fourth on your handout sheet. Quote, no piece of good fortune could have made Astolfo happier than this, for the hippogriff was the very thing for him if he wanted to explore land and sea, as he did, those he had yet to visit, and girdle the earth in a few days, unquote. Ariosto playfully underscores the difference between his notional and his character's actual voyaging by having his narrator say, in an ostensible aside to Cardinal Ippolito, and again this is the fifth item on your handout sheet, quote, you must not imagine, my lord, that Ruggiero was constantly on the wing. Every evening he put up at some hostelry, avoiding poor accommodation as best he could, unquote. Recall, if you will, the Ariostan voice of Satire 3 boasting, without ever paying an innkeeper, I will go exploring the rest of the earth with Ptolemy, unquote. Such teasing, this time about the real motivation for fictive traveling, finds full exposure in a story told in Canto 28 of Orlando Furioso by an innkeeper of all persons, which, because it is thus reported rather than experienced within the poem's larger, supposedly historical narrative, features characters engaged in imagined, not real travel, that is, the armchair travel of the innkeeper and his audience. The two protagonists of this inset novella are two young men, generally reckoned the handsomest in the world, whose wives have cuckolded them with lovers vastly inferior to their husbands in looks and status. To assuage their shame, the two cuckolds set out on a trip throughout Europe with this itinerary. This is number 6 on the handout. Quote, "Let us leave these heartless women and try all the rest to see if they are equally pliant. Let us do to other men's wives what they have done to ours. I do not mean to return before despoiling 1,000 men's wives of their prime treasure," unquote. These may, therefore, be the world's first sex tourists. But vengeful conquest is not their only goal. Delights of a less brutal, more diverting and soothing nature also invite them. Quote, "The long absence, the sights to be seen, the frequenting of women from other lands, all, it seems, tend to assuage and lull the heart's amorous passion," unquote. Eventually tiring of the risky business of wholesale adultery, these bedding crashers decide to find a young woman to share, assuming that having sex in alternation with the two handsomest men in the world will be enough to keep her satisfied. Obtaining their prey from an innkeeper, who else, they travel about Spain with her until they come to a town called Sativa, where, like the narrow-gauge topographical versions that they are of the geographically ambitious Ruggiero and Astolfo, they leave their shared sex slave at an inn, and this is the 7th handout, while, quote, "while they went out to visit the town, its palaces, shrines, and public buildings, for this was their practice every time they came to a new city," unquote. Meanwhile, the young woman encounters a serving boy, her previous lover at her father's inn. That night, while she lies in bed between her two sleeping masters, the serving boy sneaks into the bed and enjoys sex with her. Confronted with this further evidence of, as they see it, women's sexual insatiability, the two travelers give up and agree to return home to their respective wives, now at least without any debilitating false expectations as to the latter's fidelity. This misogynistic parable serves Ariosto as a send-up of the supposedly benevolent, high-minded exploration of the world proposed by Ruggiero and Astolfo. He forges a connection between high-flying, as on the hippogriff, and low-down, as in sex tourism, travels, or the imagining of them, by the names he gives the novella's protagonist, Astolfo and Giocondo. A moment ago, I read you Waldman's translation of the words describing Astolfo's joy at coming into possession of the hippogriff so that he can continue his voyage around the world. No piece of good fortune could have made Astolfo happier than this. He is the Italian. Non potrebbe ser stato più giocondo d'altra avventura Astolfo. QED. Whatever his reservations about the motives of his travel-loving characters, and despite his stress on the difference with respect to the need for inns and innkeepers between his pretended journeys and Ruggiero's supposedly real ones, it seems to me that the poet links the two modes of travels by means of the hippogriff. Introduced into the narrative of Orlando Furioso with the magician Atlanta astride him, the hippogriff, according to the Ariosto narrator, has nothing in common with Atlanta's tricks and illusions. Handout number 8. Quote, "No magical figment this horse. Unlike the rest, this was as real could be," unquote. A comic disavowal? To be sure. But the hippogriff's subsequent ability to carry both Ruggiero and Astolfo on their desired journeys in search of the world, cercando il mondo, also emblematizes the very real connection between the European voyages of exploration and discovery undertaken during Ariosto's lifetime, however purposeful and mercenary they might be, and the literary recreations of such voyages accomplished by the armchair traveler celebrated in his third satire. That is, the hippogriff is a poetic symbol for the liberating power of the map. That said, it's important to note that although neither of our two paladins claims to possess or need a map, their roots imply maps known to their creator. Maps, furthermore, that exist in a complex set of relations to his announced armchair guide, Ptolemy. Accordingly, I'll devote the greater part of these remarks to clarifying Ariosto's cartographic milieu, which might thus be rendered as a headline, or perhaps the basic premise of a movie. Ptolemy and the explorers meet at the court of Ferrara, and Ariosto finds them there. put a little less laconically, Ariosto's connection to the Este dynasty and that dynasty's particular interest in maps and mapping had an important impact on the representation of travel, at least consciously organized travel, in the Orlando Furioso. To begin then, broadly speaking, early 15th century Western Europe inherited two major cartographic traditions, one describing spatial units at the level of geography, chorography, or topography, the other concentrating on seacoasts and oriented toward navigational practice. The late medieval Mappa Mundi world map took various forms, none of which was intended as a guide to actual travel. The most schematic was the so-called TO map, a purely abstract representation of the three known continents arranged as a T, Asia across the top, Europe down one side, and Africa the other, within a circle representing the Earth as a whole. At the other extreme, you'll notice, by the way, that the three continents, Asia, Europe, and Africa, are also identified with the names of Noah's three sons, Sem, Japheth, and Ham. Okay, and the circle of the earth around is the ocean sea, the Mare Oceana, right? And then the three directions, it's oriented to the east, of course, so Oriens is on top. Okay. At the other extreme were large, ideologically driven circular images of the world, usually with the east at top, often with Jerusalem and the Holy Sepulchre at the center, and dotted with textual inserts transmitting information about the past and present, including monstrous races banished to the edges of the known world. These large world maps divided the landmass of the three known continents, again rendered schematically, by idealized representations of the rivers Don between Asia and Europe and Nile between Asia and Africa, as well as the Mediterranean dividing Europe from Africa. This is, of course, the famous Hereford world map. And right in the middle of it there is Jerusalem. And the monstrous races, we can't see them very clearly, are there around the edge. This is Europe, and you can see there's Great Britain and Ireland, right over on the edge. This is the Mediterranean, and the Nile goes down through here, and the Don, if I remember correctly, is up through here. So it's a very schematic representation indeed of the three known continents. By contrast, at least from the 13th century onward, navigational charts, usually called portolans, came into use, allowing merchants and sailors to plan and execute journeys around the shores of the Mediterranean and Black Seas, a process known in Italian as costeggiando, and as time went on, along the Atlantic coasts of Spain, France, and the Low Countries. To quote from David Woodward's introductory essay to Cartography in the European Renaissance, quote, "From the earliest extant example, the charts were structured with rumb lines, that is, diagonal lines tracing the paths of major and minor winds, radiating outward from central wind roses, and inscribed place names perpendicular to the coastline, unlike other maps of the period." This is a portolan from 1439. I'm sorry, I couldn't get a clearer image of it, but there are perpendicular on the inside of the coast, you have a little perpendicular, which are the names. This, of course, is Spain, is the Pillars of Hercules, the Straits of Gibraltar. This is Africa. And you can see this is one of the wind roses, and the winds right there's another one. And this is the way they navigated from port to port by following these rumb lines. It was clearly designed precisely for costeggiando, for local traveling. And accurate traveling, as opposed to armchair traveling. Into this spectrum of cartographic possibilities, the appearance in Florence in 1410 of a Latin translation of Ptolemy's Geography introduced a major game-changing element, though it's important to recognize that the change was neither sudden, pervasive, nor unidirectional. What exactly was the geography, more precisely, introduction to the depiction of the world, of Claudius Ptolemy, the second century Alexandrian scholar? To describe it, I'll quote from Suzanne Ziegler's excellent introduction to a recent English and German translation of its sixth book. Quote, "The work consists of 8 books. Book 1 is of a theoretical nature. Books 2 to 7, part 4, describe the maps of the countries of the world in a detailed and schematical manner, defining their borders, listing their mountains, rivers, and settlements, indicating the longitudes and latitudes of all relevant points, and enumerating the names of the ethnic groups living there. Books 2 and 3 are dedicated to Europe, book 4 to Africa, Libya, book 5 to the Near East, book 6 to the Middle East, Central and North Asia, Scythia, and China, Setica, book 7 parts 1 to 4 to India, Southeast Asia, Sinai, and Ceylon, Taprobane. Book 7, parts 5 to 7, deals with the construction of the world map. Book 8, 1 to 2, is concerned with the construction of the special maps, each of which depicts one or more countries of the inhabited world. Europe is depicted on 10 maps, Africa on 4, and Asia on 12. And Book 8, parts 3 to 28, gives summaries of the contents of the 26 special maps." So there are 26 special maps. There's a world map, and there are 7 books of descriptions of all the parts of the known world, or the oikumene, as it was called. It should be clear from this description that the maps constituted an important part of Ptolemy's compilation, for such it was, of knowledge of the oikumene, or habitable world, if only because they allowed the geography's user to attach to its lists of coordinates to spatial images for greater comprehensibility. If you open a copy of the Ptolemy, what you find is long lists saying this: there is this place, and this is its latitude, and this is its longitude, and this. So it's a long compilation of lists, and without the maps, it would be very hard to place them in terms of the spatial, as it were, imagination. Those coordinates used to establish a universally applicable system of location in degrees of latitude and longitude constituted the text's greatest contribution to geographical knowledge. In David Woodward's words, quote, "The change in the abstract conception of space from the center-enhancing mappemundi to the Ptolemaic isotropic structure of mapmaking has often been called the quintessential modernity of Renaissance cartography. The terrestrial coordinate system that Ptolemy describes assumes an isotropic uniform surface on which abstract positions are plotted on maps of the world. The implication of this apparently prosaic statement are complex and far-ranging. It implies that the position of one place is no more important than that of another. Since the surface is represented as a uniform space, scale and proportion are also possible. Furthermore, the map now has not a single viewpoint, but multiple, strictly speaking, infinite viewpoints with orthogonal lines of sight perpendicular to the surface," unquote. I put on the screen now a typical example of a Ptolemaic world map, and you can see from the lines that are drawn that they are lined. Well, you can't see the longitudinal lines very clearly, but they are there, that the oikumene is then divided by parallel lines of latitude and lines of longitude, intersecting them perpendicularly. And using them, you can identify where any place in the world is, something we're so used to we don't think about it, but it was Ptolemy that brought this system into the consciousness of the European Renaissance. It would, however, be a mistake to think that Ptolemy's system of projection was the initial reason for its popularity after its appearance in Latin. The translator of the geography in 1410, Jacopo Angeli, belonged to the circle of Florentine humanists for whom the newly available text served as yet another point of entry into the classical tradition, the domestication and appropriation of which was that audience's prime desideratum. As Patrick Gauthier Dalchet puts it in his encyclopedic consideration of the first century of the geography's reception, quote, "The work could hardly fail to attract the humanists,
who are anxious to provide themselves with a detailed reconstruction of the world as described in the classical texts they so admired, unquote. Their perspective, quote, channeled the interest in Ptolemy in the direction of philology and historical research, what we might call historical geography today, rather than toward an analysis and critique of different modes of representation, unquote. Furthermore, as exemplars of the geography multiplied and began to be printed in luxury versions equipped with modern maps, not all drawn to Ptolemaic principles, and frequently supplemented by information from navigational charts, it became a fixture of princely libraries. Quoting Gautier d'Alchet again, the spread of the geography as a geographical model can also be partly explained by the links that the humanists were trying to establish between learning and aristocracy, for it was through power that their program of cultural transformation could best succeed. Thus, all those great personages with whom the humanists were in contact naturally desired to possess a copy, unquote. The confusion of the geographer Ptolemy with Egyptian monarchs of the same name gave his text further cachet. In sum, the geography, as an icon of classical culture, easily claimed a place, with humanist backing, in the ongoing self-construction of the courts of northern Italy as aesthetic and intellectual paragons, with their despotic princes exalting themselves as patrons of the arts and sciences, as well as just and enlightened rulers. It's safe to say, then, that for someone in Ariosto's position, the attraction of Ptolemy, suggested in the third satire, was its completeness as a record of the world's places and its systematizing of that record in such a way as to imagine, if not actually undertake, itineraries based on the relative situation of and distances between the places one might want to visit. Beyond such virtues, however, familiarity with Ptolemy was also a sign, indeed almost necessary evidence, of one's participation in the humanistically fortified, aesthetically privileged world of northern Italian court culture. In fact, Ariosto's connection to the Este court resulted in the extraordinary availability to him of the full range of 15th and early 16th century cartographic developments, both conservative and innovative in temper, and in particular made the poet a privileged observer of the interactions between Ptolemaic geographical principles and the cartographic responses to the politically and commercially inspired voyages undertaken with the sponsorship of Spanish and Portuguese rulers. Two Este Dukes of Ferrara, Borso, who reigned from 1450 to 1471, and his successor Ercole, from 1471 to 1505, were especially interested in maps for both intellectual and political reasons. George Tolias distinguishes between the antiquarian interest in maps in Florentine humanist circles and Este concerns as follows, quote, the maps in the library of the court of Ferrara were a different case. There the ruling family's interest in maps reflects both scholarly and state concerns. Borso and Ercole d'Este in Ferrara had some fine works of cartography and became important patrons of the mapmaker Nicolaus Germanus, unquote. Nicolaus, a German, as his cognomen suggests, worked in Florence, and from 1466 produced three editions of Ptolemy's geography, accompanied by a progressively larger number of modern maps to accompany those transmitted from antiquity with Ptolemy's text. The first version, from Nicolaus, including maps of Spain, Italy, and Northern Europe, was dedicated to Borso d'Este. Even as Nicolaus Germanus updated Ptolemy's regional maps, less aristocratically connected cartography was engaging and modifying the Ptolemaic world map. And here I'll give you another more beautiful example of the Ptolemaic world map from the late 15th century, which showed the Oikoumene, the inhabitable earth, as a space completely surrounded by land. This is Africa, all of Africa that Ptolemy was knew. And notice he has coming out, this is all land, which closes in and means that the Indian Ocean becomes
an enclosed body of water. This is the Atlantic over here, and there's no way possibly that one could get from one to the other. This was the Ptolemaic, as it were, orthodoxy, which clearly was about to be, or was in the process of being challenged. Which shows the Oikoumene as a space completely surrounded by land. Northern Europe and southern Africa do not appear, and thin borders of land issuing east and west from the African landmass enclose the Atlantic and Indian Oceans so that passage from one to the other is impossible. Venice, deeply involved in maritime trade, was an important center of navigational cartography, the kind that produced the Portolans, right? And in Gautier d'Alchet's words, quote, provides us with detailed evidence of what developed from the encounter between charts and mappe mundi, like this one. Several extant Venetian manuscripts include Ptolemaic maps side by side with older forms of world maps and Portulan charts of Atlantic, Mediterranean, and Black Sea coastlines. More innovative is the world map produced in Venice by the Camaldolese monk Fra Mauro somewhere around the middle of the 15th century. A text on the map refers to the Portuguese voyages of discovery along the coast of Africa, and in Gautier d'Alchet's view, it is clear that this notice, quote, in answer to the false idea that the southern limit of the inhabitable world was not bound by water, was originally directed against Ptolemy, whose map, as I've noted, embodies this idea, even if he is not named, unquote. As you see, Fra Mauro's map, which, by the way, is oriented with the south at top, so that this is Europe, there is Spain, there is the Italian peninsula, this is Africa, and you'll notice that Africa is now circumnavigable by water. This is in roughly the year 1457 to 59, so in other words, it's about 40 years before the Portuguese actually were able to navigate around the Cape of Good Hope, but obviously at this point, 40 years later, it was known it could be done. Similarly, a Catalan mappamundi, the Catalans, by the way, and the people who lived on Mallorca were great map makers at this time. A Catalan mappamundi of about the same time, that is the mid-15th century, which ended up in the Este Library in Ferrara, shows a circumnavigable Africa. In this case, it is oriented the way we used to, with Europe on top. There's Spain again. This is Africa, and this rather odd. They understood something about the way Africa was shaped, not the way we would see it today. But again, you'll notice it's circumnavigable around the bottom, this being the Indian Ocean. This again, somewhere 50 years before the Portuguese actually reported having done this. The proximity in time and place of these two maps, Fra Mauro in Vienna, in Venice, the Catalan map, at Este, both from about the middle of the 15th century, serve as a reminder of the close cultural relations between Venice and Ferrara, to be sure, not always matched by amicable political relations, which facilitated the flow of cartographical information from the Serenissima to the Este domain, and thus potentially to Ariosto. As the 15th century came to an end, and with our poet now in the employ of the Estensi, extant correspondence gathered in volume 10 of the series Italian Reports on America, 1493 to 1522, documents in Ercole d'Este's communications with his representatives abroad the Duke of Ferrara's eager search for information about and maps of the latest Spanish and Portuguese discovery, information that resulted in major revisions of the Ptolemaic world map and that, thanks to Ercole's initiatives, became available to Ariosto. Writing on 21 April 1493, Giacomo Trotti, Ercole's ambassador to the Duke of Milan, passes along a copy of a letter describing in some detail Columbus's first voyage, undertaken because, quote, he wished to go across the great sea in such a way that by sailing in a straight line to the west, he would come to the Orient, because the world being round, perforce, he had to circle around it and find the eastern part, unquote. Trotti, in effect acknowledging his espionage, adds that, quote,
the most illustrious Lord Ludovico Sforza, the Duke of Milan, wanted very much to see this letter sent to the Spanish ambassador to Milan by his brother in Spain, and wanted a copy of it. But it seemed right to me to send it also to Your Excellency, that is to Ercole, because you will hear new things, unquote. A few days later, Ercole replies to Trotti, quote, Messer Giacomo, a letter of yours of the 21st of the present month has been received. And as for the first part, which speaks of that copy of the letter of Messer Annibale di Zenaro, dated in Barcelona, there is nothing to say in reply except that we commend you greatly for sending the said copy, which we read with great pleasure. And if you should hear that anything else has been written concerning this to the Honorable Royal Ambassador who is in residence there, we would consider it estimable if you would notify us, unquote. Translated from the diplomatees, good work, see if you can filch some more. Sure enough, on 10 May, Trotti writes, quote, to my most illustrious lord, I wrote in the past few days to Your Excellency about those distant islands found by that Spaniard by sailing, and I sent you the copy of a letter. You replied to me that if he learned more, I should inform you, and now I send you the copy of a letter which came from Spain concerning what has so far been discovered, and from the tenor of which I am certain that Your Excellency will derive pleasure, unquote. Perhaps Ercole's biggest catches were reeled in for him by Alberto Cantino, his envoy to Spain and Portugal in 1501-1502. Writing from Lisbon, 17 October 1501, Cantino describes in detail the voyage of Gaspar Corte Real, sent by King Manuel of Portugal, quote, northwards, solely to investigate whether it might be possible to find lands or islands in that quarter, unquote. An expedition in which Europeans, if one excludes the Vikings, first encountered what was to become Labrador and Newfoundland. Then, on 19 November 1502, writing from Rome, Cantino reports to Ercole that he had obtained from him in Portugal a sailing chart, a Carta del Navigare, for which he had paid 12 gold ducats. In this way, one of the most famous maps of the early exploration period, drawn by an anonymous Portuguese and showing Spanish and Portuguese claims to Caribbean islands, parts of South America, Newfoundland, and parts of the Atlantic coast of Africa, passed into the Este Library, where it still remains. This is the Cantino map, a more beautiful map I don't think you will ever see in your life. It's so beautiful. Here, of course, is Africa. Here is Europe. And here, these are the islands where Columbus first made his discovery. And this is the coast of South America explored first by Columbus and then later by Amerigo Vespucci under Portuguese sponsorship going further on down the coast. This up here probably represents the discoveries made further north by the Portuguese, as far north as Newfoundland and Labrador. You notice there are rum lines here. It is still done, in a sense, on the basis of a navigational chart. But it is almost the earliest map to show this much of the discoveries that had been made by the Spanish and Portuguese by sailing west. And as I say, it ended up in the library at Ferrara, where it was readily available to Ariosto. Given the documented policy of both Spanish and Portuguese rulers to keep secret the routes taken and discoveries made by their respective marine employees, Alexandre Dorsley, of whom I'll have more to say in a moment, is doubtless correct in referring to Cantino's obtaining of this map for his master Ercole as un exemple de piratage cartographique, cartographic piracy. While the Cantino map shows no signs of Ptolemaic influence, many other early maps of the Spanish and Portuguese discovery epitomize the synthesis within Renaissance culture and cartography of Ptolemaic and Portolan elements by combining cartographic representations that contradicted Ptolemy's understanding of the Oikoumene with the use of the Ptolemaic system of coordinates. To quote Gautier d'Alchet once more, quote, herein lies the originality of the use of Ptolemy in these voyages of discovery. The navigator could draw up charts of coasts, without too much thought about modes of representation. But if he wanted to locate those coasts in relation to the known world and make their position understandable, he had to resort to the manner of Ptolemy, irrespective of the errors of content that might be in the geography. For the huge spaces of the Atlantic, marine cartography, that is, of the portolans, which were designed for coastline, was not enough. It had to be integrated within a system of cartographic projections and a network of parallels, that is, latitude, and meridians, that is, longitude, unquote. It's precisely this integration that we find in the notebooks of the Venetian diplomat and intellectual Alessandro Zorzi, in which he copied early in the 16th century a collection of texts concerning the explorations and discoveries in Asia and the America. For example, again following Gautier d'Alche, quote, three maps sketched in the margins of Zorzi's copy of Columbus's letter of 7 July 1503 reflect an attempt to reconcile the Ptolemaic view of Asia with the discoveries that had emerged from Columbus's fourth voyage. The maps show the extent of the Oikoumene marked to 180 degrees. You see the degrees of longitude here, okay, on the equator. The nomenclature, and also degrees of latitude up here. The nomenclature is Ptolemaic, and two notes recall the estimates of the extent of the Oikoumene put forward by Ptolemy and Marinus and summarized in Columbus's own account of his fourth voyages, unquote. And this is another of Zorzi's sketches in his maps, and you'll notice he refers to Mondo Novo down here and Asia over here, and there is Europe over here, and these are the islands of the Caribbean. So these are attempts to make sense of what's being discovered and still put them in some way in a Ptolemaic framework. One copy of Zorzi's notebooks ended up where else? In the Ducal Library at Ferrara, and its blending of Ptolemaic theory and contemporary navigational practice is of the kind that would keep the Alexandrian geographer before Ariosto as a proper guide for at least some of his armchair travel, and the hippogriff conducted circumnavigations of his surrogates, Ruggiero and Astolfo. According to Geoffrey Simcox, Zorzi in turn received useful information for the notebooks, quote, from Ferrara, whose Este rulers had made their court an important clearinghouse for news about overseas exploration, unquote. Given the multiple possibilities of Ariosto's exposure to Ptolemy's text and to a range of maps revising or even ignoring the geography, can we say anything more specific about cartographic sources or inspirations, not only for the travels of Ruggiero and Astolfo, but for other less spectacular journeys that proliferate throughout the Orlando Furioso? Thanks to the efforts of Alexandre Doroslai, we can indeed. Doroslai is certainly not the first student of the Furioso to undertake such a chore. Michele Vernero's 1913 Studi Critici sopra la Geografia dell'Orlando Furioso is an obvious forerunner, and since Vernero, others have recognized the role played in the poem's many plots and adventures by its protagonists' ambitious, far-ranging itineraries. Three facts, however, set Doroslai's study, Ptolemy et l'Hippogriffe, La géographie de l'Arioste soumise à l'épreuve des cartes, Alexandria, 1998, apart from its predecessors. One is the availability to him of many early maps, geographical, choreographical, and topographical, that have come to light in the decades since Vernero wrote. A second is the care with which he has studied a wide variety of Ptolemaic and post-Ptolemaic maps, plus navigational charts, always taken into consideration both their date and location, in order to confine his analyses to those exemplars Ariosto could have known and used in preparing the three editions of his masterwork. Last, but by no means least, Doroslai frames his labors in a set of assumptions that gives them intellectual heft, raising them above the level of a scholarly detective story. His foundational postulate is that the journeys on which Ariosto sends his heroes to the four corners of the earth are anything but imaginary wanderings, improvised in fantastic, unreal spaces. Instead, they are carefully planned, following reputable maps and charts, either singly or in combination, to mimic famous and revolutionary journeys, such as those of Marco Polo, Columbus, Magellan, and Amerigo Vespucci, or to traverse actual routes between population centers or within and across national boundaries. In documenting this postulate, Dora's lie makes a strong, if somewhat implicit, claim. Far from being the musings of a recreational armchair tourist, Ariosto's careful construction of journeys recognizes, and in a sense celebrates, a twofold interaction between humanity and the natural world. On the one hand, the inescapability of travel, in short or long journeys, pursued in happiness or desperation, deliberately undertaken or thrust upon us. And on the other, the capacity to describe the world in words and images, and to record our travels for pleasure, for instruction, even for survival. Time permits only a few instances of Dorislai's discoveries and documentations. Here's an especially good example of his acuteness. In Canto 22, as we've seen, Astolfo, having liberated many paladins from Atlantis' castle of illusion, finds the hippogriff, on whom he will now fly to Africa. This is the winged beast, the narrator tells us, on which Ruggiero earlier, quote, had traveled the entire right side of the earth from India, that is Asia, to England. Girato dall'India all'Inghilterra tutto avea il lato destro della terra, the right side of the earth. This phrase, the right side of the earth, leads Dorislai to examine the way various maps that Ariosto could have seen lay out the Orcomene so that the whole segment of it from Alcina's island, which Dorislai, following others, equates with Japan, Chipango, appearing on world maps influenced by Marco Polo's description of its position off the east coast of Africa, to England, will appear on the right half of the map with extension beyond England to the west, constituting a left half. This criterion rules out maps that don't show Chipango, or that divide up the world in such a way that it appears at the left rather than the right edge of the map, or that present the Oikoumene stretched all across the map surface so that there is no right side on which to locate England, which leaves two maps appropriately dated which represent the Oikoumene as having a left side, namely the Novus Mundus, the New World, newly present to cartographers. The exemplars in question are the oval 360-degree map drawn by the Florentine Francesco Rosselli, 1507-1508, and the world map, also a 360-degree projection, in Martin Waldseemüller's treatise, Cosmographia Introductio, a guide to Ptolemy's geography, also published in 1507. You see, in other words, there is a right side, which includes this whole part of the traditional Oikoumene, and there's a left side. So that when Ariosto has Ruggiero travel from here to here, all on the right side of the map, Dorislai says, it must have been a map that looked like this. The dating of both maps fits with the composition of the first edition of the Furioso, published in 1516, but whereas Rosselli's, published in Venice, where he lived, could easily have come into the orbit of the Este court and thus of Ariosto, the Cosmographia Introductio of Waldseemüller was published as Saint-Dié in the Vosges province of France. So the question is, as Dorislai puts it, quote, did the Vosgian document have any chance of ending up after a reasonable lapse of time in the hands of the poet? It turns out that Waldseemüller's colleague in producing the Cosmographia Introductio, one Matthias Ringmann, came to Italy in 1508 and visited Ferrara, where he sought assistance from a resident humanist concerning features of Ptolemaic maps. So to Dorislai, quote, it's not at all unlikely that on this occasion Ringmann could have offered the Italian savant a copy of the world map. That would be a standard procedure among humanists, unquote. This hypothesis, if correct, would bring the Waldseemüller map into Ariosto's immediate orbit in plenty of time for him to make use of it in plotting not only Ruggiero's flight over Asia and Europe on his way back to France from Alcina's island, but also Astolfo's analogous return to Europe in Canto 15 from Logestilla's mountaintop on that island. Lacking the hippogriff at that point, Astolfo must choose surface travel, and Logestilla advises him to go by a southern route through the Indian Ocean to the Persian Gulf, rather instead of via a northern route, which, although shorter, offered the prospect of bad weather and little sunlight at that time of year. Looking again at maps available or putatively available to Ariosto, Dorislai sees that both the Rosselli map, this one then, and the Waldseemüller map offer the possibility of going by sea across the top, right, of Europe and Asia. But the difference between the two images is how the Asian landmass mass is represented. And in this one, you see where part of it is because it is a world map, and this is the other part of Asia. In this case, the way in which it's represented suggests that only the voyage following the Waldseemüller map would make the northern map, would make the northern itinerary shorter than the southern one. Okay. Examining the description of Astolfo's return to Europe via this southern route, Dorislai makes further interesting discoveries. Here's how the voyage is described in all three editions of the Orlando Furioso. And this is the ninth handout. Astolfo left the harbor of Alcina's Island, a.k.a. Chipango, and calmer waters, and a prosperous following breeze took him past the rich populous cities of the aromatic Indies, that is, the shore of China. On the either hand, 1,000 scattered islands came into view. As he sailed on, he sighted the land of St. Thomas the Apostle, which is placed there, when the helmsman altered course further northward, almost grazing the golden Chersonese, that's what this bit of land was called, the fine fleet breasted the ocean. As it coasted along the opulent shores, they saw the Ganges frothing into the sea. They sighted Taprobana, Ceylon, this large landmass there, and Kauri, Cape Comorin, and the sea which foamed between the two coasts. A great step of their journey brought them to Cochin, where they left behind them the boundaries of India, unquote. Many elements of this description make no sense at all if one looks at today's map of the Indian Ocean and South Asia. The itinerary is based on Marco Polo's account of his analogous voyage from China back to the Persian Gulf, 1291 to 95, but as Dorislai points out, cartographers misinterpreted what Polo wrote, resulting in various deformations of the Asian coastline, and this, especially this, which is sort of left over from the Ptolemaic map, which remember had a landmass going all the way around. Once they discovered that that Africa could be circumnavigated, nonetheless, they still had this left over from a Ptolemaic map, and it remained there until another generation of cartographers removed it. To construct Astolfo's voyage, Ariosto appears to have made use of not one but three cartographic sources: the Waldseemüller map, the one that's on the screen at the moment, again, a world map published in Florence by the Venetian Giovanni Matteo Contarini and engraved by Francesco Rosselli. Notice this is an attempt to present the roundness of the world, and the idea is somehow if you folded these two parts together, you'd get a globe. And for the last leg of Astolfo's trip across Arabia to the Nile, not a world map, but a chorography from the 1478 Roman edition of Ptolemy's Geography of 1478, in which the Nile, up which we're told Astolfo went, is presented here at this side of the map. Dorislai concludes, the very fact that for Astolfo's long journey, Ariosto was able to move at different moments from one general map to another, or again to a partial map like the Ptolemaic tabula, and vice versa, without ever losing his way, suggests that the broad outlines of the trip must have been established, sketched out in advance. Placed within the context of all the poem's itineraries, this new route will become an integral member of an entire network of journeys with which the poet sets out to cover the whole known world at the dawn of the 16th century. In the light of this comment, it's important, I think, to note that into this multiply mapped Astolfan journey, an exercise, as it were, by Ariosto in making his own imagined map out of the real maps of others, and thus joining at the level of fiction the fraternity of cartographers, the third edition of Orlando Furioso introduces 19 new stanzas in which Andronica, Logistilla's associate and Astolfo's temporary tutor, instructs the paladin in matters of direct cartographical relevance. The inserted lesson begins with Astolfo asking his guide, and this is the 10th and the last handout that I'll be using, did vessels sailing from the lands of the setting sun, from the west, whether driven by oars or sail, ever appear in the eastern seas? And was it possible to set sail from India and reach France or England without once making land? That is, doing what the world say, Mueller map or the Rosselli map, or for that matter, Frau Moro's map could have shown it could be done, but the Ptolemaic map could not. Andronic assures him that the land is wholly ringed by the ocean, although a misreading of it, and here she's referring to Ptolemy, a misreading of the extension of Ethiopia, the land ahead of us reaching far to the south, has fostered the mistaken impression of a landlocked Indian Ocean, so that at the supposed moment in which she speaks, no one attempts to circumnavigate Africa. But she continues, and we can all but hear the music swelling as she does, with the passage of time, I see new Argonauts, new Typhoses sailing, hailing from the lands which lie furthest to the west, who shall open routes unknown to this day, unquote. She proceeds to praise, without explicitly naming them, the Portuguese navigators who, quote, shall discover the limit of the long stretch of land, which makes us imagine two separate seas, while others, here to include both Spanish and Portuguese explorers, shall leave to their left and right the pillars established by Hercules, and following the circuit of the sun, discover new lands, a new world, as you can see from the map, shows this. The remainder of this addition to the third edition of the poem becomes an encomium of the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V, offered so extravagantly as to remind us that at this point in time, the late 1520s, the Este Dukes had thrown their lot in with Charles and the Spanish armies in Italy, while Ariosto himself, as an emissary to Charles' court for the Estensi, had earned the emperor's praise and patronage. This diplomatic praise aside, and Ariosto will have the same Astolfo who hears it from Andronica, subsequently learn on the moon from no less than John the Evangelist that poets are notorious liars. The passage is interesting in a number of ways. It has Andronica, without mentioning Ptolemy, prophesy, that is, announce, the radical correction of the Ptolemaic world map thanks to the efforts of the new Argonauts. Far from following maps, these intrepid sailors followed their intuition and created the conditions for new maps. Thus, the passage reminds readers of Orlando Furioso of the ongoing dialectical process by which maps, like poems, and all human acts of representation, or as we might say, cultural production, both guide and respond to human experience. Maps, as Dorisley's fine study shows, contribute importantly to the cohesion and experiential dimension of the Furioso, but as human products, they are fallible and inconsistent with each other, as Ariosto would surely recognize from precisely the way in which, as Dorisley demonstrates, he chooses among and combines cartographic representations in constructing his characters' itineraries. With this implication of the inherent imperfections of mapping in mind, it's also worth noting that celebratory passage I've just quoted from Andronica confirms the parallel between the explorers who discover new lands and Ruggiero, who, flying by hippogriff, similarly passes beyond the pillars of Hercules, only to fall victim to Alcide's wiles. Within the fiction of the Furioso, Ruggiero anticipates Columbus and Magellan, but travel also presents the knight who carries the responsibility of engendering the Este dynasty with occasions to shirk his destiny, first by being seduced by Alcina, and then, after his flight back to the west on a newly tamed hippogriff, by being ensnared in lust for the beautiful Angelica, whom he comes upon as he flies over the island Abuda, where she has been tied naked to a rock, as prey for the flesh-eating orca, or for any horny paladin who may be passing by. More sex tourism avant la lettre. In sum, as with all other human occupations, both map-making and traveling are subject to the shortcomings of fragile humanity. The line early in the first canto of Orlando Furioso that becomes a kind of motto for the whole poem can even be applied to the work of cartographers, even those as illustrious as Ptolemy. Ecco il giudizio umano come spesso erra. Look how often human judgment is mistaken. And by incorporating within itself, through its many mappable journeys, a creative homage to cartography, while concurrently suggesting, through its labyrinthine forests and imprisoning enchanted castles of illusion, all the ways in which the errant human condition resists orderly mapping, Ariosto's magnum opus makes a paradoxical, persuasive claim to be one of the most reliable, as well as most enjoyable and most disturbing, maps of that condition, its triumphs and tragedies, provided for its future explorers, among whom I make bold to include both myself and you, my gracious audience. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Professor Hannon. This was splendid because our immediately previous lecture in the series was Toby Lester speaking on the Waldseemüller map.
Fine.
And
saying, I'm sure, more about it than I ever.
Well, looking at it in terms of being the map that gives America its name, mm-hmm. but also...
Right, that's certainly true. In fact, you can see, I'm sure you show that, right. that down here, the modern editor has... Over here it says America. There it is.
Right.
The island of Florida. Yeah. Yes, it has very... Yeah, and he probably mentioned as well that that's a figure of Ptolemy, and that's a figure of Vespucci.
Symmetrically
right.
set up with this new flora. And interesting, too, in terms of the purchasing of maps, that this was bought by the Library of Congress for $13 million, I think. And I'm sure the Duke of Este was dropping a little bit of cash on his maps.
Yes, well, he paid a Cantino needed 12 ducats. Had to spend 12 to get that wonderful...
Is that approximately equivalent to 13 million?
13 million? I have no idea.
No,
but it's interesting. It ends up by saying, could you please pay me back, boss? I'll be very grateful to you if you send me 12 ducats by return post. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we tend to think of mapping as so rational now, and you show that it can be associated with things like madness and seduction. drawn into that. Okay, I want to open up the floor for a few questions. Are there questions out there? Bruce?
Well, I have a slightly tangential question. I'm wondering...
All the best questions are tangential. Go ahead.
It's also self-interested, too.
That's good, too.
I don't know much about the sources of Orlando, the literary sources of Orlando Furioso, but I know that the story of the two beautiful men who... were cuckolded by their wives.
Is it from the Arabian Nights? Yeah?
Well, it's related to the... probably stems from the Sanskrit story or the Arabian Nights, but it's actually close to a North African variant of the Arabian Nights that I'm working on at the moment called 101 Nights. So I'm wondering if in the world of scholarship of Orlando Furioso, is there much more is known about the origins of that particular episode, but it also makes me think that even before all these maps were gone, there's sort of a literary geography as well, given that I assume there are other themes and motifs and anecdotes that are taken from all sorts of...
In the Furioso, he leaned heavily on Boccaccio, he leaned on... Well, the actual text of the Furioso is a kind of cento of quotations from the Tre Corone, from Dante, Boccaccio, and Petrarch, just at the level of lines, you know. But Boccaccio clearly influences in some of the sort of bawdier episodes, and Dante in various moments that are actually... Well, the passage where Astolfo goes to the moon to find Orlando's wits, first he goes down into a version of hell, then he goes to the earthly paradise. The whole thing, there are about two cantos there that are a direct parody of the Commedia. So, Ariosto...
What about further beyond
then the classical tradition, of course, and beyond Italy, France, of course, all of the Arthurian Charlemagne stuff. So it's all over France. Now the question is, I think the question you're raising, and a very good one, is about what about when you get outside Europe? Is that part of what you're...
That's part of it.
Yeah, sure. And there, and I'm not...
I guess it's in part that you described the discovery of the physical world, when in fact they probably had many literary materials that had already come.
Yes, and the very fact that in an odd way
confirming that, the very fact that 50 years before the Portuguese round the Cape of Good Hope, people are making maps that show it can be done, suggests there's a great deal of traffic going on. Now, how is it going? Commerce, obviously. Venice especially. Venice had, you know, was an enormous commercial maritime empire. And people who travel bring back stories. You know, there's no question that that's really true. There's a wonderful moment in Chaucer, in the Canterbury Tales, where one of the characters is being asked to tell a story, and he says, you know, I can't think of a story. I wouldn't have been able to think of a story if it weren't that a merchant told me a story. And that's the story I'm going to tell you. And, of course, the story starts out by talking about a group of merchants who travel from Rome to Syria and bring back stories from one to the other. So it's laid out right there before us, the answer to your question, in a certain sense, not by a Venetian, but by Chaucer all the way up in London. Yeah, merchants, where there's commerce, there's going to be, obviously, a transfer of literary materials of all kinds. There are going to be documents, there are going to be maps, and especially there are going to be stories. And the Decameron is full of stories about merchants sitting around telling stories. So we know, you know, it was a dull life. They spent all day at the office, and then they get home over a beer at night, and they tell stories, mostly scabrous stories of the kind that we hear at the inn. Yeah, no, there's no question. Now, the precise answer to your question is, I don't know. I would be amazed if someone hasn't done more research on that. I simply don't know it, and that's my fault.
Why don't we have some refreshments and pull tables together, and we can discuss informally in a few minutes. Join me in thanking one more time.
Thank you very much for listening.
Example of the instability of text. I mean, the manuscript of 1001 Nights and all related to it vary immensely among them.